This is the Liminalist, a podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com talking to Jameson Webster. Feel like all the world is unchained.
My bed locked me up, even though I was screaming. Hello. This is your second today?
I was talking to my sister this morning, so that's a much more relaxed and casual affair. Although, you know, I really do aim to make these as relaxed and casual as a conversation with my sister. And to blur that line as much as possible. I'm just getting a closer look at your avatar, which is quite freaky.
True.
It's a bit better in close-up, right? When it's a little image, and when I, you know, my first sight of it, I was expecting to see an image of you, of course, and so, oh my God, what's happened to Jameson? I don't know if that's intentional or not. I'm guessing it isn't.
That was a doll at my friend Andy's house today, actually, when I was waiting to talk to you, but I had the wrong time. So while waiting, I snapped a picture of that doll.
Oh, so it's very current. Huh. Well, I did have a thought about it. I don't know if I should share it or not. It might be quite presumptuous. Do you want to hear it?
Sure.
Well, there's a question. Well, the thought I had was that maybe it has something to do with now I'm having trouble putting it into words. I wondered if you find being physically attractive a burden sometimes. That was the thought that I had when I saw that image.
It's a little bit of a burden, that's true. I had I worked for a blind man for 10 years while I was in graduate school. And I thought it was fantastic that he couldn't see me.
Yeah.
And I was at a conference once, a psychoanalytic conference, and I was there with the blind psychoanalyst. His name was Norbert. And this other analyst said, "Why have you chosen this cripple for your father?" I never thought of him as a cripple or anything like that, but I said to him, "Because he can't see."
He can't see if you're physical, your surface, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, it's funny that that came up so quickly not the subject of your physical attractiveness, but the idea of choosing a cripple for a father, because my father was a cripple. So.
Huh.
Yeah.
What was his difficulty?
He had a genetic. I don't know if it's correct to say a wasting disease, but anyway, a genetic disorder which got progressively worse. It was in his toes, and he ended up in a wheelchair. So it began with just a weird walk when my mother met him, and then it became an actual limp, and then by the time I remember him, he was walking on canes, and then by the time he died, he was in a wheelchair. Yeah. So, for me, the association of cripple and father is total, and obviously more than just symbolic, but also very symbolic. I mean, are there any fathers who are not crippled?
I think Jordan Peterson has a theory about this.
Right. Yeah, well, it did seem as though we were going straight to Jordan Peterson there with that with that sort of free associative chain of dialogue. Not, I wasn't thinking what you just said, but I was thinking of him as a father figure. Mm. And my own theory, which I put in an email to you, that he's actually quite wounded, and that therefore he's unconsciously identified with all of these wounded men that he's attempting to rescue. And I mean, I haven't gone much further with that, but
I think he must be wounded by the other academics. I'm sure they didn't take so kindly to the sort of synthesis of empirical psychology and Jung and I don't know, the sort of literary tropes that he uses. I can imagine that the kind of academic that he tends to go after would have had zero patience for what he does. And so I can imagine that that must have wounded him greatly.
Well, he's certainly been taking the blows since he's become, you know, a prime target, since he's become so visible, and many of the attacks are of that nature, like the intellectual we deserve, or the stupid person, smart person, things of that nature, very snarky.
Mm.
But I wonder how much that I mean, that definitely suggests a pattern throughout, but wouldn't... I mean, I always want to go right to the root, and my own sense is that wounds... it's pretty hard to wound us once we've grown up and developed sure. scar tissue. So then I can imagine Jordan Peterson being provoked by that environment of academia, and even perhaps deliberately trying to provoke it by going against the grain. But I'd say that's different than being wounded. That's like being motivated in a sense by one's wound, which is certainly, I would say, is very sure. common, that we're driven by our wounds.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it didn't start with the university. But I suppose I don't know much about him prior to that. Maybe you do.
Not a great deal. And actually, I've avoided going there on this current investigation for a number of reasons. But that's generally is my tendency is to want to go into a person if a person gets my attention, a public figure. And there's been a series of these now. I'm like a serial investigator. I don't know what the right noun would be there. It's obviously more than an investigator, because what I'm serializing is these father figures in the culture. So they're not father figures that I've known, although there's an overlap, of course, from somebody in the culture. One can feel like one knows them. Or there are cases where there's been some correspondence. So even though they're public figures, at least they've acknowledged my existence. And then there's the case of this Canadian spiritual teacher, John DeRuta, who I physically met and knew, because he was, you know, he's a small, like a fairly small following, just a few hundred people. But in any event, there's been these series of figures that I've encountered, whether physically or not non-physically. And that I've ended up feeling compelled to investigate, and in order to try and understand or map my own wound, and so it's been a natural tendency to want to discover their wound and to go into their past, and that's also entailed trying to investigate their social background and their affiliations, in terms of who might have formed their personality, who might have supported them and backed them in their early days, whether they're part of some more covert agendas in the case of figures that I've been drawn to, because they're public figures. I find that there do tend to be covert agendas behind public figures in my experience. It could be my bias, but there's definitely a lot of evidence in most cases. But anyway, with Jordan Peterson, I haven't wanted to go there. No.
I mean, it's interesting how much he glosses himself. I mean, I don't want to go there either. I mean, I didn't even for a second think of Googling it, but I'm surprised that I didn't. And then I was just kind of looking back in my mind at the things that I've listened to over the last couple of weeks, and he speaks as if he speaks personally, but he actually doesn't say anything very personal at all.
Sometimes so, he does.
Something about his wife or his child, but it's... I don't know. I don't think I haven't felt anything that is particularly revealing.
Well, let's think. He's talked about his daughter's illness. The thing is that, you know, I think in every case I've heard him talk about it, he's talked about anecdotally to illustrate a point. And I find that I'm just thinking this now, but that's very distancing for the listener because he himself has distanced himself from it. I think once it's become an anecdote and a means to illustrate a point, it's like he's become his own case study, or his child has, and that I would say that that's the opposite of speaking personally. That point, although it's kind of funny because that is something I attempt to do in my writing. So I'm not sure I certainly hope there's a difference in terms of that. If I'm writing about Jordan Peterson or Whitley Strieber or whoever it is, I want to, whenever it's relevant, I want to bring in my own subjective experience and sometimes my past as well. I think the difference is that it's spontaneously coming up, and so I feel I can't conceal it.
He has a deck of cards that he shuffles that are the anecdotes or the aphorisms or the kind of quotes that he's pulled from the great writers, and then his, you know, sort of series of tropes that are important to him to kind of move around on the chessboard. So it's very different than a kind of revelation of one's subjective experience in the moment of writing or speaking about something, I think.
Yeah, that may even be the crux of the difference, that sort of a line, I suppose, that liminal line that I'm always seeking to stay on. Ironically, it's the thing that Peterson preaches, which is stay on the line between order and chaos. And it's that line of always being in the subjective moment and letting the response, the necessary response happen, like the therapeutic space, essentially. It's very hard to stay in that place. We explored that in our last conversation, and Peterson certainly seems to be aware of that. And now it's making me think that there's this thing, I'm sure you've heard it or experienced it, that psychological knowledge can be a very powerful weapon for avoiding the truth.
Yeah, I think there's a very intense sleight of hand here. I mean, I think he can say that he wants to stay on the border between order and chaos, or he wants to speak to chaos or speak to the dying father because of chaos and the revivification of culture, but I think he speaks about it. I don't think he speaks it. And the sleight of hand is that while he says these things, he's somehow doing something that's the opposite. I find it very hard to put into words, but I mean, he's the one who knows. Conspiracy theories aren't chaotic. I mean, they're paranoid in structure, so they have like a kind of absolute knowledge and absolute order, like within the kind of conspiracy system. He's got a series of enemies. He has a series of tropes. He's a storyteller. And I think most of these things are on the side of order. Law and order. So.
I don't want to get stuck on this, but that you brought up conspiracy theory right at the start of that list is challenging to me, because certainly I agree about the overall that he's prescribing order and even imposing order onto chaos, I would say, and advocating a form of order or a belief or a faith in a form of order that I don't think is healthy. That's a large part of my distrust of what he's presenting. But I don't find, well, first of all, it's interesting that you refer to conspiracy theory in relation to Peterson, because he distances himself very much from the conspiracy sort of culture.
Oh no! What I mean is the Marxist takeover.
Well, I know what you mean, because he does get accused of being a conspiracy theorist by leftists. Periodicals, right, and stuff, because of the cultural Marxism and the Frankfurt School. Now, I haven't actually investigated the Frankfurt School, but what I read about it based on the supposed paranoid view sounds very familiar to me from what I have investigated about the Fabian Society in Britain, which was my grandfather was part of it, so that was how I ended up investigating it. And it actually was on my mind last time we spoke, because I know that you studied the New School, and the New School is a Fabian organization. It has Fabian roots, and so I was kind of aware of that. Well, just I wonder if Jameson knows, but I didn't want to go into that, because it's you know, it took me months and months to dig up all this information and put it all together in such a way, and to avoid theorizing and just let's just look at the data. And it was truly, for me personally, and I'm somebody who always has been sympathetic with the conspiratorial worldview, but when it started becoming about my own childhood and background and family members, then it became truly disorienting, and so I felt I'd actually finally reached the ground. And the irony of that is that actually conspiracy, when it's encountered in real life, is chaotic. Because it undermines our sense of order. But it's true that there are people who not create necessarily, but they discover, and then they sort of buff up or over too quickly accept conspiracy theories that have been put together, you know, well, incompletely, let's say, and that presumably does provide a sense of order. And I think that was probably the case for me. But I think what I would say now is that some part of me knew that I grew up in an environment that was conspiratorial and that there was a cover-up, and so because I was imprinted with that, I was naturally drawn to try and make sense of my world in the present without having to go into the wound, and so I was just looking for narratives, you know, that were impersonal orientate myself by. And ironically, I suppose this is the therapeutic process, eventually they led me back to my own, the very thing I was trying to avoid, they led me back into.
I mean, don't get me wrong, if the cultural Marxists had this incredible plan of kind of destroying all Western values by, you know, implanting professors, and they realized that the Marxism was going to work, so then they mutated it into postmodernism and identity politics. I mean, if I believe that the radical left like had that capacity and that conspiratorial nature, I'd be thrilled. Just unfortunately, having been in the middle of all of this, it seems unbelievably far from the truth.
Why would you be thrilled?
I don't know, because there would be people who still really believed somehow in radical leftist politics and had maybe enough wherewithal and organization and thought about the present day to do something, as opposed to the fact that I just don't think that that's true. It's a professionalized, unfortunately, it's been professionalized by academia and has lost any of its edge.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, the connection between the kind of current day identity politics is with the cultural Marxism is a kind of radical severance.
Mm.
Of the more grandiose goals, for better or worse, that existed with Marxism, for example.
Right. Well, so, but that, see, I wouldn't. the social engineering, so far as I've been able to understand it, and it's not a million miles away from Jordan Peterson's paranoia, even though, in my view, it's woefully insufficient, his paranoia in this regard. But anyway, what I've come to understand or believe is not that there were groups of people, the Fabian Society, for example, who created psychosocial research and think tanks in order to foment these values that they believed in, because they believed in the values, such as these leftist ones of equality and so on and so forth, but because they understood, through an understanding of group psychology, that these would be the most damaging kind of values to propagate to the family unit and to the society and to the individual, to render the individual, you know, psychologically, to strip our tools from us as much as possible. That's my understanding, and I'm surprised that we're talking about this at all, but certainly so soon, because I wouldn't want to be in a position to be trying to persuade you that this view is correct or anything, because, as I say, there's an awful lot of data to go through, and it's, you know, you may end up with a totally different conclusion if you went through it. But just to address your point, that it wouldn't be something to be thrilled about. There wasn't idealism behind this. It looks like idealism, but it wasn't. It was that these values were useful for achieving ends that had nothing to do with what they were, professedly valuing. See what I mean? It wasn't very eloquently put, but it's very hard to separate the extent to which sort of generational psychological damage just causes a deterioration of society, but also these increasingly progressive but sort of disconnected from reality values, to separate that from a consciously directed agenda by those traumatized individuals who've managed to transform their trauma into a kind of Nietzschean will to power, which can, I imagine you're familiar with that there are individuals. There's probably a small percentage of severely traumatized individuals who, rather than just being completely broken, just become unbelievably pathologically driven.
I mean, there's a lot of variables at work here. I mean, probably the cultural Marxists of my imagination are not the sort of socialists of your family, and that's also probably something to do with the fact that mine are in my imagination for the most part, based on readings I've done, which is very much opposed to the ones that I've run into working in universities. But I mean, the contradictions of the left of a variety of degrees, if it's the whatever, the Marxist, the cultural Marxist, the postmodern Marxists, the socialists, the whatever, aristocratic progressive liberals, the libertarians, you name it. The contradictions within that domain, I think, is what Jordan Peterson speaks to powerfully. I mean, this is what's been revealed by our kind of current state of affairs, is that the left is a mess. So it is sort of apropos the discussion. I mean, I did, you know, in trying to do a little bit of listening to him, you know, could encounter some of my own great disappointments in what he comes to say. I mean, it's not the whole of what he has to say, but it is a seductive part of it, is that he articulates something about the mess of the left.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that's to the great satisfaction of his right wing listeners, but I think that was what struck me, especially in his conversation with Camille Paglia, for some reason. I mean, both of them I intensely dislike, but there's some kind of impossibility that they have their finger on that is really important.
Mm. I think that's essentially the appeal of Peterson. I can't really say somebody like Peterson, but I do think it probably appears many times, you know, in the culture and simultaneously and so on, but perhaps particularly evident now, or the need for it. It's somebody who says no to the bullshit, who says enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's probably a tradition of that, essentially. Individuals who have, well, I mean, I suppose you go to somebody like Hitler, if you want to go right to the to the sort of most extreme and exaggerated example, that, you know, tyrants do tend to come to power on a tide of dissatisfaction, of social dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of well, it's got to be historically understood, like but we've also seen it in our own lives, and maybe this is, you know, another way to frame what I was trying to describe about my family, that the people who are willing to say no don't necessarily know what to say yes to. So, like, my family, yeah, they were saying no to the rigid conventionality and the intolerance of whatever you want to call that, Victorian values or right-wingism, or I think it's very difficult to label it by its very nature. It's more like a psychological orientation, but anyway, towards being closed-minded. And so they wanted to be more open. I mean, this is just giving them the benefit of the doubt that they wear what they seem. I don't think that they wear, but there would still be that in play. They're not just one thing. And they wanted to be more open, and so then they were exploring things. And it's a reaction against what was done to them or what was inflicted upon them. And I suppose, because, yeah, as individuals, we all experience this, at least if we're psychologically aware, that we want to say no to our parents, but it doesn't help us to know what to say yes to. Like, if we just do the opposite, that's not going to work.
I mean, this is the great conundrum in analysis to an extent, because you have the identifications a lot of times, which are obvious, which are based on, you know, what Freud called the neurotic family myth, which you can identify with. You know, this is what we are. This is why we are who we are. This is why we are the great family that we purport to be, or where we came from, and so on and so forth. And then you have counter-identifications, which are important, especially in adolescence, that you essentially say no, but it's just a kind of reversing the polarity of the identification that's already there. And they're just two sides of the same coin. So the whole point of psychoanalysis is to just untie the whole apparatus. But then the really interesting question is, what happens then? And I don't, you know, it's, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. I don't know that I have a great answer. And you see in a lot of the various schools of psychoanalysis that they end up kind of just putting another identification in place, like that you can identify with your analyst. Well, why is that any better than having identified with your neurotic family myth? You know, or some others have different ideas about, you know, like when you kind of finally untie this, then there can be mourning, and then, you know, there's like a greater elasticity. You don't have to kind of harden your identity around these things. But I don't know. I mean, I really, an experience that I've had in my own analysis and even with patients is that when you untie these threads, there's an abyss. And, you know, Lacan actually is one of the people who spoke to this. He called it destitution or desubjectification. And I guess, you know, he said kind of basically all you have at that point is something like the fabric of the drive or the grain of language that you can kind of surf around in this, but that it is terrifying, and it is almost abyssal. And, you know, with this idea of like the destitution of the person, I mean, you almost have this idea of them like a pile of slime. But he had this joke that at least they could get out of the room by slipping under the door. They didn't have to open the consulting room door anymore. They just like ooze out of the treatment at that point.
Wow. How would they feel, though?
I mean, I, you know, in my own personal analysis towards the end, I mean, I remember being furious about everything that the analysis took away from me. And thinking like, I, you know, like this, I, you know, 15 years later and I'm left with nothing. But I think probably I would prefer to have nothing than to have this illusions or something.
That's the Beckett thing. There's nothing between us, and that's love. When there's nothing between us, then we can really connect. So it's when there's nothing between us and our souls, then there's a connection with the soul. And I don't think that that can be narratorized. As in, this is my story now, I'm the person who's in touch with his soul, and this is what my soul is telling me, and it seems that there's... I mean, I don't see how a psychological process can't end up with a religious orientation.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in Beckett, it's usually old people and garbage, and it's like, it's not anything narrativized, nor is it like any religious redemption by any stretch of the imagination, even if there's certain moments like that where, you know, it's a little bit more beautiful than not.
Mm. I wonder if that was... I mean, I haven't read Beckett. My mother loved Beckett, and I don't know if I would like him or not, but I do think that religious feeling or religious experience can and, in a sense, must express itself through anything and everything, not just through religious interpretations. Like I spoke to somebody recently here, Theodore Dalrymple. I was thinking this just earlier when you were talking about left and right. Like, those terms don't mean much to me. I mean, I grew up with leftists, and as I say, they were, you know, they weren't really that pleasant people. And anyway, I'll bring it back to Dalrymple. And he, you know, he's I think he's often called right wing, kind of, not exactly right wing. He's certainly a conservative, which I have always associated with right-wing. And he's also professes to have no religious faith. He hasn't actually self-identified as atheist, so I have to wonder there what he's holding back. But he certainly says he doesn't have any religious faith. And yet his way of being, and okay, I could be fooled, he could have a hidden, you know, side that is completely at odds with his way, but I think I have a fairly good sense of people now, and it's very warm, and it's very embodied, and he's very present, and I would say he has a I don't actually know what word to use now, because I don't like the word spiritual, I never have, but religious hardly seems better, but, you know, a way of being that one would hope to associate with religious people if we didn't have this now, this negative imprint about what a religious person is, i.e., you know, a suicide bomber is the postmodern association of, you know, the current association with religious. But anyway, I was kind of going off on all the different points there, my main one being that being in touch with reality and with our true essences could be expressed through old people in the garbage or anything at all.
Right, yeah.
And it seems like it's almost a safer way to express it. I mean, I'm certainly on this point now where I feel like I can only trust the mundane. If you know what I mean. I don't know if I should extrapolate
no,
that.
I never thought that I would be someone with a taste for the quotidian, but I think my disillusionment, and it's not, I mean, it's not necessarily true about the things that I read, but perhaps I listen more for that in the things that I read than I used to, but sort of disappointment with academia. With what I ended up finding there more as an adult person than, like, I suppose as a student. So, I agree with you. I trust the quotidian more. I just actually trust listening to people speak.
Yeah. Is quotidian synonymous with mundane?
I think so. Like the everyday, the sort of...
Well, because we're not really talking about the everyday now, so it's not as though I'm not still drawn to explore, you know, the very depths of human existence. I don't think I'll ever cease to go deeper in there unless there is a bottom. But well, I suppose it's not either or, as I was saying. I mean, it's not as though I've turned my back on spirituality any more than I guess you've turned your back on academia, but it's kind of knowing, getting to know the lay of the land and getting to accept that it is 99% bullshit. But that kind of makes it a richer experience to really to have to develop one's discernment to the point that one can identify the real and the signal in that noise. It seems as though that's the process in itself is that one the more one develops one's discernment for the signal, the more one can turn up the volume and the more one can withstand the noise, the deeper one can go, I think. I mean, because that's been my experience as a psychological subject, is that I go deeper and deeper into discomfort and uncertainty and confusion and despair while feeling better about it.
I mean, it's interesting. For some reason, I was just thinking that the things that I've come to trust, I mean, even if we're talking about liking the mundane or liking the quotidian, I just prefer a discourse that's like completely wild and out there, than the kind of commonsensical tell it how it is, this is what we've had enough with of the Jordan Petersons. And a lot of, I think a lot of intellectuals would verge on to the kind of main in that way. And like things that I was reading before, like Badiou would write a book about love and, or, just this kind of way in which there's a moment in which the person feels that they want to comment on the kind of state of things, as opposed to the person who's just gone like to the edge. I mean, I read a book by one of the earliest psychoanalysts. His name was Ferenczi, and the first book that he wrote during World War I was called Thalassa, which is about the sea. And he had this kind of just bizarre conclusion that, I mean, very beautiful in a certain way. The other title that he gave it in Hungarian was The Catastrophe of Genitality. But the idea was to take Freud's kind of phylogenetic idea that there's like not just a replay of the origin of the species, but a replay of like the entire history of the earth within psychic development. I mean, you can see where it has a kind of Jungian bent to it, but it's much more Freudian. And that the great catastrophes was the drying up of the seas. And if we came from the sea, in the sea we were bisexual, in the sea we didn't have genitals, in the sea the environment around us was nourishing and wet and plentiful. And when the seas dried up and we had to crawl onto land and develop genitals and develop intercourse and divide into two sexes, that this was the catastrophe, and eventually sort of harbor the child on the inside rather than just kind of release them into the world almost immediately. And he plays this out, and like, of course, the one thing that anyone ever remembers about this book is that the sea inside is the amniotic fluid in the mother. This sort of like really beautiful idea, and that the semen is trying to, get back to the water. And that this is how he wanted to interpret Freud's kind of nirvana theory or Otto Rank's idea of the trauma of birth, this idea of trying to get back to our thalassal environment. But what he ends up saying is even stranger than the fact that like being born is traumatic or, one is always sort of searching for nirvana. It's basically that the place that we want to go back to, it happens. It happens in conception to the extent that the semen finds its way back in, the egg is fertilized, and then this in this sort of sea-like environment is created. But you're not there. You're not there at the moment of conception, and you're not there when you're a child. So we're essentially seeking something that we will never, ever again be present to. And this is why he calls it a catastrophe. You know, and I, you know, you sort of read this, and you think this is totally nuts and very, very beautiful. And maybe more useful to us in some ways than any common sense.
And I hold two less chances, and I even made you wear warning bells. Some nights I wake up in my dreams, my doll on the inside of an icicle ball, shivering, wrinkly and numb. You know what to do, don't play dumb. Gonna lick, lick, lick away. Gonna lick away. I'm gonna lick my wounds out of here. Push me right into the well. I put up the fences, I hold two less chances, and I even made you wear warning bells. I'm gonna look, look, look away, gonna look away. I'm gonna look my wounds out of here, you hear?
Well, it has some things in common with the theological narrative as well, which is the fall of Lucifer and how that pertains. That's the etiology of the ego is sort of represented in the myth of the fall of Lucifer, and that Lucifer was separated from God and reacted against that separation and tried to reclaim his prior oneness with God, and that, and therefore he turned his, you know, his birth, if you will, into a fall by putting his focus backward, by directing his desire backward to what could never again be. He turned the manifestation into a fall, and so it actually became a fall. He became, you know, Lucifer. He became a satanic figure because of that reaction against and that resistance to the present moment, the inability to let go of the past.
Mm.
And that's, I mean, in terms of the ego that's formed through trauma, which is sort of, again, like the symbolism of the thing that emerges from the water and takes, you know, genitalia, or even genital organization, and becomes an identity, to the extent that it does react against that process because it's too traumatic, it's unable to live. It's unable to enter into the present.
Mm. I mean, Ferenczi was the person who's held up now as, you know, kind of fighting Freud and advocating for the necessity of thinking trauma, that Freud had, you know, in his going away from the seduction theory, went too much towards these kind of universal fantasy structures against, you know, actually the sort of idea of trauma and psyche.
Hmm.
So, Ferenczi was the one who wanted to do both, or at least wanted to hold on more to trauma than Freud had wanted to after a certain point.
Hmm. And how effective was he?
Ferenczi?
Yeah, in terms of communicating that.
He died young. With Freud, he was like Freud's enfant terrible. You know, Freud loved him very much, I think, you know, maybe more than most of the others. And at the same time, you know, they were constantly bickering with each other about this or that. And Freud called him whiny and too feminine and said that he didn't work hard enough. And but, you know, I think they had a very passionate relationship with one another. Unfortunately, Ferenczi died young.
Hmm.
And he's very vogue at the moment. I mean, I wish actually for some of how much stranger he is than kind of being trotted around in terms of his ideas of trauma and healing. Not that I don't believe in trauma and healing, but I wish we could have the trauma and the healing and then the absolute strangeness of some of his ideas together.
Hmm.
But I mean, one might suspect that all the way through, Freud did kind of take into consideration many of his ideas. You know, I mean, and Freud also comes back to fetishism at the end of his life, which is a little bit like the catastrophe of genitality, and he rewrites his Oedipus complex as something that, it, yes, it's a fantasy, but it also needs to be destroyed, otherwise it hangs around in the same way as, you know, what you were talking about with Lucifer. So his question was like, not just that one has an Oedipus complex, but one actually has to destroy the entire thing in its entirety. And how does that, he's wondering how that takes place. And I mean, other things that I think he probably got from Ferenczi, including not being rigid technically as an analyst. I mean, Ferenczi, you know, wanted things like mutual analysis, that patient and analyst would analyze each other. I don't think that's a great idea, but he at least really cared about the communication between the unconsciouses of the analyst and the patient. You know, and then Freud actually wrote some of the stuff that he wrote on telepathy because of Ferenczi also. So well, I think they're... No, go ahead.
Wasn't it Ferenczi's theory was ORFA as well, the organizing life principle, I think it was short for?
Is it ORFA?
ORFA, like A-R-P-H-A. It's a contraction of something, I'm pretty sure, because it's central in my Prisoner of Infinity thesis. It's to do with a dissociative mechanism which allows the psyche to connect to like a higher cosmic principle, and so it can it can actually access transpersonal truths, but only at the cost of being split off and dissociated from the body. And that's
that sounds very Ferenczian.
Well, that's, as I said, that was very central to my Prisoner Infinity, and really to just about everything I've been looking at, like the lens that I've been developing to look at modern culture and particularly spirituality, of course. But I wonder, I mean, you say about Ferenczi's strangeness, and see, what I like about Ferenczi, besides what I've read and what you've said, and that, you know, I already had a good feeling about him, is that people don't know who he is. That he didn't have influence. Like, that to me is evidence that he was onto something. I think the ideas and the teachers and the leaders who gain traction in our culture only do so because they are complicit with the ego structures that maintain our society, let's say. That there's just something about the nature of, it's like, you know, as above, so below, something about the nature of the defense system of the individual and of the whole society that those individuals create, that is constantly conspiring to prevent consciousness from happening. So, although, you know, I've got so much from psychology, I've ended up at a point where, and maybe I was kind of always there, although not so much with Jung, where I don't trust psychology per se. Like, and we talk about that time with Freud, and, you know, when it was beginning, it's as though I get this sense, not based on very much, to be honest, but it's more intuitive than intellectual, but that a bunch of individuals were on the cutting edge of something socially and scientifically and so on and so forth, spiritually even, and they were exploring something and discovering something, and that was a moment in which something was able to come into form, but it was only really able to come into form in such a way that we still talk about it today, by adopting the norms of the time, by not being too wild, by not being too strange, by becoming dogma, is really what I'm saying.
Sure.
And that's certainly how Freud was, from what I've read about him. He was like trying to start a new religion. It wasn't about...
No, I think Freud was so weird. But you're never gonna get me on. I think that Freud's followers killed what was weird in his science, and he didn't even want the International Psychoanalytic Association developed. He didn't want training. He thought that it kind of had to be a crazy hodgepodge thing that was somewhere between art and science. But this idea of a like training with the rules, with the oversight, I mean, he was on the side of this. But he also, I don't know why entirely, but he let it happen. I mean, he would kind of make recommendations against it, but he would let them do what they were going to do. I don't know if that was his own greed in terms of, you know, spreading the word or the good word or whatever. But, I mean, to me, up until the end of his life, he continued to do the strangest things. I mean, he didn't do what one should have done if one wanted to start like a nice, you know, like a doctorly reputation for psychoanalysis. I mean, you don't write Moses and Monotheism, certainly, as one of your last books. I mean, it's a very weird book. Mm. You know, and some of the kind of late wild conclusions about the splitting of the ego or the structure of fetishism and all human sexuality. I mean, I don't think he compromised. But I think that he's been diluted, and certainly by psychiatry. I mean, at least, especially here in the United States.
Hmm. Well, this is a case where, and I'm more and more aware of these cases, these situations where I don't know enough to have an opinion, but I already have one, and yeah. Before I spoke to Theodore Dalrymple, the reason I reached out to him specifically for any, you know, any number of reasons, was around Freud, because he'd done a talk about how Freud was very much like a cult leader, and how he worked very hard to start this religion, and he presented all this evidence, and so I wanted to talk to him about that, because I found it interesting. It turned out we never got to it. So I didn't get to talk about that, and so now it's an interesting experience to have you say something that's almost the opposite, and I can't, you know, like, I'm not going to argue with you, because I don't, you know, I'm not Theodore Dalrymple. I found his case quite persuasive. So for example, with conspiracy, one of the reasons that that whole subject has become so polarizing is because those who disbelieve it, well, neither side, those who disbelieve it and those who believe it, haven't gone far enough into it. So those who believe in conspiracy, you know, as in an overarching conspiracy that the whole of society is kind of being manipulated, have a very simplified and, you know, frankly unconvincing sort of narrative around that, which makes it very easy for those who want to dismiss it it's like we create these straw men unconsciously. So the real opportunity is in not taking a position on things, it seems to me. That's the liminal space. It's actually, ironically, that's the thing that Freud said that I love to quote, which is that human beings cannot tolerate ambiguity. And I feel as though it's like, and I've tried to write about this, so I have written about it around Peterson, that we're all constantly negotiating for a safe space to feel safe, and that one of the primary ways we do this is to try and ascertain the extent to which the other people in our environment agree with us, and we'll validate our point of view rather than being willing or able to let go of our point of view, which, as you were saying, seems to be the therapeutic process, is letting go of points of view.
Which I think, although I don't know, is the opposite of what Peterson wants, even though he thinks it's important to wrestle and retain the concept of truth. and have an experience of chaos and breakdown, but you do this in order finally to shore up your position.
Mm-hmm.
I think I listened to a couple of his, you know, like he had a podcast for shooters, and then he had another one that was written for millennials. So I was curious as to how you're speaking to the, you know, whatever the young broken people / men of the world. And, you know, he says to them, like, you need to break yourself down, you need to read, you need to learn to author yourself, you need to, you know, explore the chaos, you need to understand that there's truth. But in the end of the day, truth is a position against another position. You know, sidebar, this is where those academics who tell you that there's no truth and there's only revolution and change are wrong, and they're evil.
Mm-hmm.
But that they have to be oriented, that they have to find their kind of compass and their northern star, which is essentially to take a position,
mm-hmm.
finally. And that they will, he sort of promises that if they take this journey, they will come out with a position that's strong.
Yeah.
And he said, no one told you that this is why you needed an education in the humanities. You needed an education in the humanities so that you could write, you know, your arguments, you could outline why you believe what you believe, and then you will be unstoppable.
Right.
Which is the opposite of how the humanities. No, I don't know. I mean, not that you don't have a, you know, not that you don't believe anything, but it's meant to kind of like so that you can live with the ambiguity and instability.
Yeah. To be able to respond, just because, mm-hmm. I mean, however much we know, we can't know everything, and it's impossible to have a tool set that can see us through any situation, unless we're going to become like super soldiers who just, you know, like. I mean, I suppose if you see existence in a particular way, like a jungle you've got to hack your way through, then you can get the tool set and you can just live that way. But that's an imposition of your tool set on your environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, it does seem to me that Peterson's view of psychology, of psychoanalysis, he's a clinical psychologist, so
mm-hmm.
it is about functionality primarily,
mm-hmm.
as in just making you more competent in the world.
Right.
So I find it very challenging, or very suspicious, really, but contradictory, that he's putting that in a context, apparently putting that in the context of spirituality, religious archetypes, and so on and so forth.
Well, he mixes incredibly strange things. I mean, he mixes spirituality with positivistic kind of nouveau psychology, empirical psychology, you know, so it's sort of stats and results and based on, you know, whatever standard differential. So I find the mixture of those two things very, very odd, and it's a lot of evolutionary Darwinism also, then you know, with a love of literature. So it's a wild mix.
Yeah, but it's I mean, for him to make it functioning as a system, it has to all be subservient to an underlying set of principles. And of course he's anti-ideology, that's his dragon that he wants mm-hmm. to slay, so that is dependent on the belief that his system is non-ideological,
right?
But there's no there's no evidence for that at all. And I think that I think his method for arguing or convincing himself even that his system is founded on non-ideological principles is by referring to science and specifically to Darwinism,
mm-hmm.
as if they're you know, untouched by ideological beliefs.
Right. And also not to make certain criticisms, because if you make certain criticisms, for example, of free market capitalism, you're going to get in big trouble. So it's that he never questions it, ever.
Yeah.
You know, things are the way they are because this is where they've come to be. It doesn't mean that they couldn't be better. It doesn't mean that they couldn't be more just. Of course, we have to fight for these things, but I'm not going to take the ideological step of criticizing free market capitalism. Mm-hmm. In which case, the goal is to be competent within the free market capitalistic society that we have.
Mm. Yeah, which he's modeling also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In a way, it's generating a great deal of envy as well as admiration.
I read the statistics of what, you know, $80,000 alone on donations on YouTube or whatever it is a month.
Mm-hmm. And a bestseller and just world fame and adoration, basically. Yeah, it's kind of what at least the damaged infant in all of us, particularly men, I think, most desires. So that is to be raised up by your community.
Mm.
That's the end of the first part of this conversation with Jameson Webster. Part two will be up next week at the Liminalist, horticulture.com/Liminalist, the podcast between. I'd like to thank everyone who supported me in this endeavor. There's an accompanying blog post about Jordan Peterson embodying, modeling, and mapping the masculine, or is he? That's at horticulture.wordpress.com. Next week's podcast is with Nicholas Hausdorff. If you'd like to support this enterprise, you know what to do. Don't hold back. This is Jason, and again, it is the Liminalist, the podcast between. Till next time, keep on trucking.